From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made every day now as students across Rochester and Monroe County and Western New York adapt to new learning environments. There's no ideal situation and solution for school in a pandemic. And whether students are back in the classroom full-time or in a hybrid situation or fully remote, families and kids especially are learning to make adjustments. Did you ever think it would come to this? It's amazing what's happening this year. And experts in child health and education say the pandemic will have lasting effects on children's social and emotional needs and their overall well-being. They say kids will experience a wide range of feelings as they navigate this unprecedented time. And yes, I keep picking on myself for using the word unprecedented. That's a word that's overused. But not this time. This is unprecedented. There's no roadmap here. And coupled with a national racial justice movement and events here in Rochester, it's affecting students' social and emotional health, especially students of color. So how can parents, caregivers, and teachers best support them? Well, Rock the Future and the Children's Institute are entering a new partnership to address these needs. In April of next year, the Children's Institute will become the new anchor entity for Rock the Future. That means experts with both organizations will try to be better able to focus their work on children's health and education and how those needs are intersecting. So this hour, we talk about the partnership and we walk through what families and educators need to know about how to best support and empower students during the pandemic and during a time of social unrest. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Jackie Campbell, director of the Rock the Future Alliance. Jackie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sean Nelms, the chair of Rock the Future and superintendent of East. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Anne-Marie White is executive director of the Children's Institute. Anne-Marie, welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
And Elizabeth Devaney is director of the Whole Child Connection with the Children's Institute. Elizabeth, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to talk about what all of the organizations involved here are doing, how things are going on the school side with Sean coming up here. But I do want to just start by asking what our guests are sort of what you make of what you're seeing every day in the streets of Rochester and how that connects to the work of making sure, you know, kids are protected and healthy socially, emotionally. You know, some kids are very, very well aware of what's going on and this is a moment of potential real change. Jackie Campbell, how are you seeing some of these events in the last couple of weeks and how it impacts? Does it impact the work that you're doing? Does it impact kids in a significant way here?
I would say absolutely it does. And we have if I would just speak a little bit to the school district, 90% of the children in the school district are children of color. And so what is happening right now is affecting them as well. We have, if we're talking specifically about being remote, we know they have less access to some of the adults and even their peers that they would normally be checking in with. But this is a very stressful time for the entire country and certainly for Rochester. And we should, it should be our understanding that our kids are watching what's going on. And in the particular neighborhood where some of the social justice protests and things are happening, our children live there as well. So absolutely this is impacting them.
Sean Nelms, how do you see it?
Yeah, I think Jackie explained it exactly the way I see it also. I think we have to understand that, you know, students have been out of direct contact with their peers and their supportive staff since March, and it's likely they won't be seeing them until, you know, mid-October at the earliest. So, and they're hearing about these issues through social media and some reports which may be slanted or show bias. And so what school provides is an opportunity for kids to analyze varying perspective and viewpoints on a related topic, and then to be able to make thoughtful decisions and inferences for themselves. And not having the ability to have those constructive conversations with their peers may cause our students to have increased anxiety and depression or confusion, or to respond in ways that are not healthy. And so we want to make sure that we, through this remote time period, provide an opportunity for them to process this information meaningfully and constructively.
Anne-Marie, how do you see it?
building on what Sean and Jackie are saying, I mean, as educators, as parents, as individuals who care about children and work with children, we know that children are more than brains on feet, right? And when they cross through the threshold of our homes and into schools, you know, we can't ignore all parts of the child. They're all interconnected, and we want to care and hold for every one of them. You know, we, for instance, in my family, when one of our children start acting out, we'll say, are you hangry? You know, recognizing that maybe we want to just start taking care of their basic needs. We know both with the confluence of what's happening with COVID and the challenges, the real challenges that's having for families. We know with the, you know, workforce issues and the disparities around that right now. And now, obviously, we know the effects of trauma that that can have on children and adverse experiences layered and compounded. It's almost like two tracks are running, and we want to be very attentive to the influence of what's happening right now in terms of exposure to racial violence and racial discrimination, because that's a unique trauma in and of itself, and that does speak to, again, ways that we want to really promote coping in a strengths-based way and really as a village that's coming around our children that's also living through this.
What do you think, Elizabeth?
I agree with everything my colleagues have said. I think the one thing I would add is just, you know, when I'm thinking about our youngest children, really, they're exposed to what the adults in their lives are exposing them to. You know, so I think the fact that children have been home, haven't been out in the usual spaces, school, you know, community activities as much as they have since, you know, since March, there's this sort of every child is getting a different level of exposure to what's going on in the community, depending on how the adults in their lives choose to share it with them. So some children may be out at protests every day with their family. Some may, you know, really not be hearing about anything if their parents have chosen to try and kind of shelter them from that. So I think we have to sort of recognize that, especially for younger children who aren't on social media yet and aren't hearing, you know, seeing things in other ways, that they may have very different kinds of experiences and exposure. And then I think, you know, there's something going on in kind of the white communities around parents really trying to reckon with how much do I talk to my kids about this? How do I bring up these subjects? How do I start having conversations I've never had before? That I think is also really important and is having an impact on kids, you know, in addition, as everyone said, to all of the stuff that's happening with the pandemic. So really just sort of knowing that there's no one size fits all and how kids might be feeling and experiencing all the very many things that are going on in their lives. And also the kids are so reactive to the adults in their lives that, you know, whatever they're getting from the adults is going to be having an impact on their own emotional states.
Yeah, and so as we talk about this partnership, let me just ask our guests to kind of describe a little bit for listeners who might not be fully aware of what each organization does. Well, we know Sean, we know East, but Anne-Marie White, the Children's Institute, talk about the mission there.
So happy to and thrilled to be entering into this deeper partnership with Rock the Future. We have been around for over 60 years. We, as an organization, work to equip and support those that work with children in a whole host of ways, teachers, child care providers, parents themselves, to ensure the success of every single child. So we really want to continue to attend to issues of equity, school readiness, social and emotional well-being. And we do so really tending, again, to those people that come around children and support them in the way that they come around children so children also benefit.
Elizabeth, can you also describe the whole child connection for the listeners?
Sure. We've been a division, if you will, of Whole Child, of Children's Institute for about 3 years. Had some tremendous support, initial support from the Greater Rochester Health Foundation to kind of build a capacity building center, I would say, for really the adults who work with kids around the idea of whole child. So helping adults intentionally focus on the whole child. We have a special emphasis on social emotional learning and what that looks like in schools. But we also work with out of school time providers, childcare providers, and increasingly kind of building connections with the healthcare community as well, health and human services.
So Jackie, how is this partnership going to have an impact on Rock the Future?
For the listeners who do not know about Rock the Future, we are a collective impact initiative. So we are an alliance that pulls together our leaders and stakeholders, families, parents, youth, to really focus our energy on looking at what we can do to improve outcomes for young people and implement some of those strategies. But it is the collective nature of Walk the Future that is probably the biggest value. And so we are this convened body, and what we have been doing is growing our reach, I would say, and looking at health, because we, you know, previously we looked at academic well-being and focused almost singularly on the educational or academic space. And what we have been doing is expanding our reach and growing our partnership and really just having different conversations about well-being, not just the academic piece of it. I love when Anne-Marie mentioned, you know, kids are more than just brains on feet, and that the social emotional wellness is intricately connected to academic outcomes, but any outcomes. And so this allows us an opportunity to be more deliberate about that connection and that collective conversation that we need to have as a community.
Well, as I look outside the window here in High Falls, I see a hazy sky. I'm thinking about what kids might be making of this moment. We've got one of the most probably the divisive feelings in politics and elections that I can ever remember happening. We obviously have the pandemic that has disrupted everything. We have protests in Rochester daily and nightly with calls for change. And now we have a hazy sky because there is literally smoke that has come to Rochester from California fires. I mean, all of these things happening, and yet, you know, what you want to be straight with your kids, but you also don't want your kids thinking that the world's ending tomorrow. There's a lot of balance for parents. Let me read a couple of comments already. Andy says, I'm lucky that my kids are middle schoolers and mostly self-sufficient, but like any parent, I worry. I'm also heartened to know that they're doing this. They're making it work. And for the rest of their lives, they know they can handle anything. Here's a comment from a mom. She says, Evan, I'm so grateful for this hour. I'm listening while watching my first grader vacillate between being bored and frustrated with her virtual class and then delighted at the exercise game she's doing in her virtual PE class. So many emotional ups and downs for her every single day. Those are two of the comments from parents. Sean Nelms, what are you hearing from parents? And if you could also, what are you hearing from your teachers who are trying to make this work?
Yeah, and I want to just echo what your two parents felt. I am a parent. I have a student who's in eighth grade, a daughter who's finishing her senior year or starting her senior year, and an older daughter who's already graduated from college and is trying to work in a virtual setting. And so like those parents, it is interesting, it is intriguing, it's frustrating at times, but I do think that these moments build character. At East, we were fortunate that prior to COVID, we were building some pretty robust curriculum. And so the transition around what will be taught was already addressed. How we were going to teach it was where we struggled. And so we spent a considerable amount of time this summer, 9 days of professional development, focused on how to teach in a virtual environment, how to make it engaging, because to simply teach like you would do in a brick and mortar and just do it online was not going to work, and kids were going to disconnect and not be engaged for school. So we're hearing from parents a great deal of appreciation that we put a lot of time and energy into planning for a virtual classroom experience, but we also hear from parents the struggles that they have with trying to, if they have Wi-Fi issues or students are locked out of a Zoom for some reason or kids are trying to be inappropriate during Zoom meetings. I mean, you have the best and the worst all at the same time. But what I'm most impressed by is we have organizations like Rock the Future and our primary care practices like pediatrics and family medicine and our behavioral health providers who are working with us so that the messages that we're sharing in schools throughout the county are also being shared by primary care physicians and being supported in other avenues throughout the county. And so I guess the positive takeaway from this is that by working together, we're able to have a consistent message around some of these issues. We can identify the stressors that may cause trauma and depression, and that we would have a plan for providing support and not stigmatizing kids and families during this time who may need some additional mental health support and or academic help. And I think that type of coordination is truly at the heart of what Rock the Future represents and what we seek to accomplish.
Sean, can full remote happen for the full year? I mean, I know it very well might, and it will happen for all districts if the numbers dictate that. But what I guess I mean by that is, you know, do you feel like there is enough of a rhythm that this can happen without being too disruptive come spring and next summer?
Well, I think it's how you contextualize disruption. So I think if you compare it to what we used to have in forms of traditional schooling, then no. I mean, I would say you can never replicate what happened in brick and mortar to what's happening virtual. If we redefine and reimagine schooling through a virtual lens, then I would say yes. But there are things that you're going to miss. Sometime it might be sports or that direct interaction with students. But helping the community understand where they can engage and how to engage with friends safely would be something we would have to emphasize, particularly in the spring. The winter is always dreadful in Rochester, depending. And so how do we keep kids active and during winter months when the snow's high? I mean, so it's possible, but it's going to take a complete community effort. And again, this is what the Children's Institute and Rock the Future and our primary care physicians are preparing for. Do we desire to have remote learning for the full year? Absolutely not. But if it has to happen, we have to make sure that our teachers are prepared and supported to do this work and make sure that the community is knowledgeable about how they can engage and be helpful also.
Well, you're touching on something that I think is absolutely vital, and I want to ask all four of our guests about this because Rock the Future for years has given us these annual updates on how kids are doing, disparities in outcomes and opportunities, how they're doing in various areas of learning. And we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago that has really stayed with me. I have a lot of empathy for teachers. I'm a parent myself, like you, Sean, like so many who are listening now. I'm thinking about teachers who have to be creative no matter what district they're in. I'm thinking about Dr. Leslie Myers-Small, who had a very hard decision to make with a lot of different considerations to make to try to figure out should we go full remote to start. Ultimately, of course, they did. Here's the conversation I'm thinking about, and as it relates to what Rock the Future has been telling us for years. The conversation was a couple of weeks ago, and Adam Urbanski, the head of the Rochester Teachers Association, was on the program. He, of course, had advocated for full remote, which is what RCSD is starting with. There was a parent of color named Pablo Sierra. Pablo was on the program. He's got three kids, and he said it was devastating to have to tell his kids, you're the only district in this county that's not going back in person at all. And Pablo said, look, we already have disparities in outcomes when you look at just categorically kids of color versus white kids. You have disparities in outcomes when it comes to suburban districts in the city school district. And his concern was that when you look at it this way, when you confront the fact that in this state, the districts that are starting full remote tend to be the mostly urban districts in Monroe County, it's only Rochester, that it's going to widen the gap. Now, it's possible at the end of this, we're going to look back and say, boy, RCSD was not only careful, they were wise, and everybody's going to go full remote when things change. Or maybe not. It's impossible to predict that. But his concern was, we see those numbers from Rock the Future every year. We see what was happening, and this is going to bring that gap to a really, really hard place when there already is a gap. Sean, do you see it that way?
I think Pablo's speaking from a parent's perspective, and I think I want to validate and say he's right if he feels that way. I will tell you that it is quite possible that we will see gaps widen. And even the medical professionals are at odds about school opening. We have one of the lowest rates in the country. And so some would argue that that all kids should be in school and that the social-emotional toll of not being in school and those impacts will have for years. At the same time, there's a lot of unknowns. And like you said, you know, we may look back and say, hey, you know, RCSD made the right choice. I would shift the conversation and say, if we're going to start all remote, what guarantees can we give Pablo, that parent, that their child will have access to rigorous curriculum, they will have teachers who will be logged in and attentive, that the kids will get feedback on their learning, and that we can try to recreate to the extent possible a meaningful learning environment. I think if we can guarantee, and Pablo sends his kids to school, in the first couple weeks the kids are actively engaged and they're learning, then I think his stance may change. But if he, for the first 3 weeks of school, teachers aren't logged in and the kids are having horrible experiences, then we prove him correct. And so our job as educators is to make sure that we partner with agencies, we partner with the community to provide meaningful learning experiences. And I'll quickly say this. I said to my son yesterday, who finished all his assignments by 11 o'clock in the morning, and he said, Dad, I had the rest of the day to myself. And we sat and I said, you know, if you were in college, it's possible that you would be done by 11 o'clock on a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday course. And so how are you going to plan the rest of your day so it's meaningful so you're not playing PlayStation the entire time? And so we talked about time management and making sure that he doesn't see time the teacher is not making him work as a missed opportunity to learn about something that he's really interested in. And so I gave him a book by James Baldwin. He read a chapter, and I had a conversation about that. So I think parents have to also help think about how we expand schooling so it's not simply what we've experienced in our own existence, but giving kids additional learning opportunities based on things they may not have to do for a grade. So that's an important tip and technique for parents to consider also during this time.
Okay, Jackie Campbell, how do you see it?
Wow, we have these conversations all the time, and I so appreciate Sean's comment about the role of parents and the actions that they can actually take. And that's good when there is a parent who's home, when you have adults who are in the space where children are and who are able to lean in that way. And I totally agree that it is about how do we galvanize our community to be able to support parents and families in this particular moment. Absolutely, we're going to see the gap widen. And part of that is we had systemic issues before the pandemic, and we have done nothing to address those particular issues. So we have no reason to believe that kids are going to be able to do what they needed to do before, and that the system is going to respond to them as it should have before. This is why it's critically important that we are having this collective conversation. We've not mastered how we support children's social and emotional needs, not just in school, but actually in the community. So we have to be thinking about that. And additionally, we also have to acknowledge that we don't have cookie cutter kids, and that there are cultural responses that need to be in place. And so to the extent that we can support and lift those cultural models to support children and families, we will be on our way. But this is not going to be business as usual that we're doing like we used to do. One of the things I joked about was that for those of us who were old enough to remember the Jetsons, and I don't know if the Jetsons is still playing now, but we're never going to have education the way we had it before. It's not going to be going back to that. But what are we doing right now to provide the support for all children so that they can be successful, and we can actually narrow that gap? And that's the space that Rock the Future was leading into.
Okay. Anne Marie White.
Building a little bit off what Elizabeth said to start, we acknowledge that we're facing a unique set of challenges that's hard for everyone. But it challenges us differently. And we have heard, working and talking with parents, that really there are a group of parents that do feel more safe to have their children home. And we also hear that there are parents that really need help and really need to lean in and support with more on-site services for their children. So recognizing that there's not any one view of the whole system, because there's so many differences, and how we experience this is layered in so many ways. And part of what the issue is, no one has any full view of like all the impacts that this is having.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best we can do is to try to communicate and talk as we're really flying the plane while we're building it. And really it's asking a whole bunch of things of different people to change their roles, adapt what their daily activities are. And we just have to hold one another through the kind of stress, anticipatory grief. Like I can imagine for that second group of parents, it's like, what fresh hell is coming my way now? How am I going to handle this? We just have to come together as a community through this moment and help one another really bring a sense of coherence, which is how we know we cope with such kinds of stress. And so we have to start asking critical questions of ourselves, the organizations we work for and that we partner with. Are the resources available to make these shifts? Do people feel that they can manage it? Is there the right leaning in and supports available so people can learn new roles? And is this meaningful for folks? You know, how do we do this in a way that brings satisfaction to their life as well? So, you know, the inequities we know are there. We're at a moment that we can try to also address those and see new opportunities, as Sean was talking about, you know, to change our role and to do things different. And we are seeing some of those pieces emerge. At the same time, we know there are less prevention services out there. We know that we may not have as full of a complement of a universal prevention and crisis support piece in place that we had really, you know, worked really hard to embed comprehensively in schools. But at this moment in time, if we keep working together, you know, we hope that we can close some of these gaps and really address the challenges that we know many families face and that many children will face.
Well, and I want to ask Elizabeth a little bit about something that Sean Nelms was talking about. You mentioned that moment that a lot of parents are experiencing now when kids at 11 a.m. say, well, I'm done with my work. And you're looking at the rest of the day and what you want to do is exactly what Sean's talking about, is instilling some independence, some self-direction, and an idea of finding purpose. And we know that the research indicates kids need a sense of purpose to thrive, whether that's being connected to extracurriculars that they might not have right now, purpose perhaps in school, even in sort of their social settings. And so we're a little bit limited in that, and self-direction is important. How do you instill that in kids, that sense of purpose, when we're a little limited now?
Yeah, I was thinking, as soon as Sean said that, I was just thinking about the weight of all of this, you know, the intense weight of this on parents, because it puts a lot of pressure on them to figure out what to do when their kids are done at 11. I had a similar experience with my kids, and I did not do anything quite as astute as giving my daughter a chapter of James Baldwin. I think I might have said, I don't know, go find something to do. So, because I had a Zoom call to get on. So, you know, I think for working parents who are home, there's the sort of, how do I juggle my job and my kids? For people who have to get out of the house, there's the going to be a lot of siblings taking care of each other and, you know, alternative situations. So I think, you know, we can't understate the pressure that parents are under to try and figure out how to fill this gap. And so I think that's where, like Anne-Marie said, we need to kind of figure out how can we provide parents with supports, figure out some alternative places and spaces where people are coming together. So whether it's, you know, in the faith-based communities, whether it's, you know, there are some out-of-school time providers who are still doing virtual things, or where there are some small group, you know, courses and classes and after-school activities that are happening in socially distanced ways in person right now. So working with some of those kinds of providers as well to help them kind of think about what are some activities we can give to kids. I know for my kids, if I tell them to do something, they're less likely to do it than if a teacher or, you know, another trusted adult tells them to do it, because there's just that relationship that parents, you know, it's hard to be your kid's teacher. So finding ways to support other adults to help parents, I think, is really critical, that we can, you know, find some other sorts of resources. So if there are, you know, places that kids can sign up for activities that they're interested in, if there's additional ways we can draw on, you know, the community, I think that everyone's willing to be creative. As Sean said at the beginning, we really need to think creatively and outside the box, because we've been trying to stick with the same old solutions, and I think we're struggling there. And, you know, so finding ways to provide other opportunities for kids in other settings and from other adults in their lives, I think, can be very helpful.
Sean, before I go to break, is there any truth to the idea that giving them Baldwin, yes, everyone salutes that, but are you also just telling them to watch Bill's highlights all day now?
You know what? All day long.
Come on.
They get that for PE credit.
My friend, I just had to, for you, this is, I'm very happy for you. Talking to Sean Nelms, who is the chair of Rock the Future and superintendent of East High School. Jackie Campbell's the director of the Rock the Future Alliance. Anne-Marie White, executive director of the Children's Institute. Elizabeth Devaney, director of the Whole Child Connection with the Children's Institute. This is our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, talk about a new primary care collaborative as well, and a lot going on here as we think about the challenges, not only of raising kids, but helping support systems that educate them, teachers, all of the challenges happening right now. And these organizations are at the core of that. Let's get our only break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, an update on the local eviction crisis. We look at the current state of the issue and how residents can access assistance. Then in our second hour, two local villages are exploring a new clean energy project. We'll talk with leaders in Brockport and Lima and climate change activists about what they hope to accomplish. Talk with you on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jackie Campbell, tell me a little bit about the new primary care collaborative that we're reading about here.
Well, we have a group of pediatricians and health professionals who are looking to lean in specifically around whole child health and wanting to support our children and families in any way that they can, and really looking to lean into working with the with educators, the education system, teachers, administrators, and so on. But particularly, we're focused on how we can support the school district at this particular moment.
So that's the primary care collaborative. There's so much happening with these partnerships, and I'm hearing from people in the community. Here's a note from a teacher who I will not name, who just mentions, Evan, I'm really loving my time home with my kids when I get it, but I think I'm doing much better on that front than on campus right now. She's a teacher in a local K through 12, and I'm thinking about teachers, you know, who might feel a little overwhelmed right now. And can I ask our guest to weigh in on what it means to support either teachers or systems right now when everything is feeling a little bit stressed at the seams here? Jackie, what do you want people to keep in mind on how to support in the best way possible?
Well, I think I want to defer that to in terms of supporting educators who are also parents and who are also really trying to do the work. And I want to defer that to Sean. He has a better sense of that.
Yeah, go ahead, Superintendent Nelms.
Yeah, I would tell teachers to, and I said this to our teachers at East, I said, you know, do not try to plan the first 10 weeks of school all on the first day. And you have to really take it in bite-sized chunks and continue to have being reflective and leading to your peers and your colleagues for support and guidance. Another thing that we say at East, which may sound weird, is I encourage people to celebrate their incompetence daily. You'll hear me say that often. and people often do have that reaction, like, Sean, what the heck are you talking about? But if we're expecting teachers to create classroom environments where kids are encouraged to fail forward, then we have to encourage school environments where teachers are also encouraged to fail forward. And that's to learn from their mistakes in an attempt to try new things. And we don't want teachers to feel stagnant or to feel ridiculed for not having the best virtual learning experience. So we constantly say that. The other day, a classroom was Zoom bombed. Teachers felt really bad about it. We contacted the teachers, and I said, listen, it's not your fault. I want you to focus on the 99% of the lesson that went really, really well, and we'll deal with that 1% offline. But I don't want you to be distracted because something happened that was unexpected. So we have to encourage teachers to find balance, to practice self-care, to take opportunities to say, I don't know what I'm doing in this situation, admit that, and then seek a solution so they can be better for themselves and feel more accomplished, but also they can be better in instructing those classroom environments. So my heart goes out to every educator out there, especially those teachers that are trying to plan these creative lessons, and I'm just going to encourage them to not take themselves too seriously, allow themselves some permission to fail, and to celebrate their incompetence daily.
Elizabeth, how do you see that idea of supporting, you know, maybe the teachers in our kids' lives or you know, the different structures that they're kind of moving through during this pandemic especially?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I agree with Sean that the idea of sort of acknowledging that this just isn't going to be perfect is really important. We've been doing a lot of self-care training. That's been the most requested training that we have, and that's not usually what we're doing in this first couple weeks of school. I think that there's sort of this recognition that teachers just need to take a minute for themselves and acknowledge that they're under a lot of stress. I know, you know, some teachers who are going into schools and hybrid models are feeling anxious about being exposed. You know, those who are all virtual are wondering how the heck they're going to engage their students all year. you know, so giving yourself a break. I think also attending to relationships, like taking the time on the, those virtual Zooms to, or team meetings to, you know, talk to your kids, do funny relationship games, you know, have a house scavenger hunt, whatever the things are, you know, there's lots of different ideas out there for ways to kind of engage kids, take the time to do that, as opposed to getting really stressed about the learning part of it right in this first few weeks of school, just so that kids can start to feel connected to each other and to the teacher. I think that's really important. But I think also just acknowledging to the students that you're a little uncomfortable. You know, my son's second grade teacher said, "How many of you have butterflies? I have some butterflies. This is going to be a weird year. It's a little different than usual. I'm feeling a little nervous. You guys might be too." And I thought that was great that she acknowledged that and, you know, just took that minute to sort of say, "I'm nervous and you might be nervous too. And let's all be in this together."
How do you see it, Anne-Marie White?
Well, you know, we have that metaphor of, you know, put the mask on yourself first and then help one another. Mm-hmm. And certainly, as we look to all the caring adults around kids in our community, you know, that's how we want to start the conversation and really support and recognize, you know, their feelings, the hard work that's ahead of them, the responsibility that they feel around that, their desire for competence and for excellence in what they do, and how uncertain a lot of this feels. And just recognize, you know, through that self-reflection, you know, that they'll be developing competencies to respond to their children that are around them in similar ways, who are facing, you know, similar feelings too. So it's a moment really to build empathy for all of us, for all the learning, as Sean was saying, that we need to do. These aren't technical problems where we can just come in and change a light bulb and, you know, and everything's going to be different, or we can just hand out a piece of equipment and somehow virtual is going to go great. You know, these are adaptive problems, which means we have to look at our values, how we think about the work, you know, what it means in a different context. And that takes, that kind of change takes time. It's deep. It's powerful. It goes to what Jackie's saying. We won't, it's part of the process of why we won't be the same when all this is done, because we're learning through this in ways that really have us, you know, think about education and how we work with kids fundamentally differently. But, and we want to create that emotional space for people to feel safe, grow those, you know, feel the roots, feel that security, and then hopefully, you know, the creativity and the wings will emerge, and we'll see the kind of innovation that we do hope for as well in terms of children's services.
I want to turn back to Jackie Campbell, the director of the Rock the Future Alliance, because as we talk about what it means to offer support during a pandemic, we have to acknowledge racial disparities on some of the outcomes. I mean, the rates of infection, frankly, the rates of people who have died from COVID-19 in this country. We know there have been disparities, and I actually just put in a request for new data locally, because unfortunately we're nearing 300 deaths in Monroe County. You know, we're all hoping that numbers and rates of infection will stay low. But Vox Media just put out a little study of the entire country looking at how each state is doing on COVID-19. And there are no states in the country that meet the standard of where we want to be on all four categories that they have. And if you're saying, well, where's New York State? Why isn't New York State? We just went above 1% in terms of positive community rate for the state, for the first time in about 2 months in New York State. So that's the one that we're missing on. The bottom line is, you know, we don't have a big outbreak locally, but this thing is not over. We know that it's not over. And we know that vaccination is going to be an important story. The CDC said today that their best estimate, if you trust the CDC on this, their best estimate is third quarter of 2021 we'll have enough vaccine to essentially move the country back to quote-unquote normal. That's a year from now. So, Jackie, we know that this is, you know, we're still maybe even in the first half of this thing, and there's a long way to go. And when it comes to helping communities overcome, number one, disparities, bad outcomes, rates of infection, but also mistrust of vaccination or immunizations, concern about access, what can be done, especially as we move through 2021, and I think we hope that we see more access to vaccine, to make sure that there is equitable access to healthcare, to vaccination, and that where there is mistrust, we can counter that.
So that's a huge question, part of it starts with, I would think, telling the truth. And so as a Black woman, I can acknowledge that there is mistrust of the health community, the medical community. What are we doing to address that? And part of that really begins with, can we acknowledge what has happened in the past, and can we actually take positive steps to address that as we move forward? And so when, you know, we were having this discussion and about what is the message and who are the messengers and who are the credible messengers. And so we have to have some honest conversations with ourselves. So it's not like there's going to be sort of like a miracle vaccine and people of color are going to be rushing to it. The Black community is going to be rushing to it. But we have, between now and then, we have time to have some honest conversations and sort of develop those bridges and also develop some strategies in terms of how we build message and build credible messengers in the community. So we have to acknowledge that, but it's tied to a larger issue that we have with systemic and structural racism in the country. We are, I believe, waking up to the reality of the situation, and COVID sort of ripped the sheets off of it so that we can, you know, there's no more hiding from it. But, and you know, it's not just about sort of having this information, like what are we going to do differently, especially as it relates to communities of color that have been negatively impacted.
Can I just ask sort of a clumsy question, Jackie, that I'm just trying to make sure I understand better here? You know, when early in this pandemic especially, but really it, this perpetuates, we know that most testing, when you find testing sites, you know, the early analysis was, boy, there it's in the suburbs, it's in mostly white communities, it's in wealthier communities. So more people of color are dying from COVID, and more testing is not near where a lot of people of color live. That has been true since the start of the pandemic. I hope that that has started to evolve and change. But when it comes to vaccination availability, I don't know the system, the program for how it's going to be rolled out. But let's just say that it's somehow equitable and that everyone's got equal access to a vaccine. Generally speaking, do you expect resistance in largely Black communities?
So I would speak to the data, and we were just having this conversation yesterday. If you look at flu vaccine, that you will see that communities of color are less likely to get flu shots, and particularly in urban areas, as Rochester is designated as one. So I don't think that we should expect anything different with respect to a COVID vaccine without doing something different. So, and I'll just speak honestly as a woman of color, that I've wrestled with whether or not I get a flu vaccine. And I've talked to other people in my community about that. So, I think that we will sort of, you put it closer to the folk. The question is, will the folk go out and grab it? And unless we do something different, the evidence says that won't happen.
Hmm. Evan, can I comment on that?
Please do, yeah.
So I would say, just for context, and I think for the listeners who are wondering, like, why wouldn't the folks of color go out and take a vaccine, I would encourage them to just find the movie, The Tuskegee Experiment. And it's one of many instances in this country where different vaccines were experimented on Southern Blacks. And so there is mistrust between segments of the Black community when it comes to medical professionals, because we know that historically we have been used. And for that particular film, the Tuskegee Experiment is how syphilis was given to a group of men untreated, and many died from it, went blind, et cetera. So that's a prominent story that's told in the Black community, and it makes people nervous about any type of vaccine or experimentation. That's one. Two, I would say that there are efforts underway to bring a different perspective from the medical field, so that the communities of color are better informed about science now, and how, you know, you can't use human subjects in trials. There was a recent community gathering that was led by a sorority and fraternity organization, Phi Beta Sigma and Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated, and they did something, partnered with the University of Rochester, and targeted folks who are in the Divine Nine sororities and fraternities to better understand what this is all about and to encourage folks to participate in those trials. And I know that the mayor recently is working with the state. I think Dr. Archie is supporting this effort also to bring some of the testing to the communities of colors in churches and community centers. So to your point, a lot of these things are being addressed, but you're absolutely right. There was a time when even though the death rates were high, the support and guidance was not happening in the black community. Again, there's a historical context why people of color are leery about medical trials. And again, that Tuskegee experiment is a really good film to watch with families, just to understand that within this country, people of color were experimenting it on to really save the more dominant culture from the impacts of these diseases. And then lastly, to say that I know the mayor has an initiative coming out, and I know that there is a great deal of attention being paid in Rochester to make sure that if and when a vaccine is available, that the communities understand the importance of taking it and being or at least considering that option.
And just briefly, Sean, you know, this is another, I imagine, an example of why representation and leadership matters, because if, given the history that you're describing, you can understand why communities of color will have distrust. If you don't have representation in the science communities or leadership communities telling you, hey, this is safe, let's do this,
yep.
How do you get buy-in?
You're absolutely right. And I think also, I think it's important, this is American history. I always say that because it's not black history, it's American history, that every American understands the reticence of people of color because what happened to them in this country. I'm not talking about 100 years ago. These experiences were happening in the 50s and 60s. So I want to make sure that people truly understand that these things are real, they're relevant in these communities. And if we become, as an American culture, more knowledgeable about these things, then we can share information and we can start to counter misinformation about diseases and cures and vaccine trials.
And if I may, Evan, just jump in here.
Please do.
I mean, you know, thinking about both what Jackie and Sean are saying, I mean, Jackie started to say, you know, we need to be doing something different. And I think what Sean is pointing to is the kind of different that needs to be done by those that are running these trials, are conducting this research, you know, are working very deliberately to earn that trust authentically and engage persons of color in the research. We know, for instance, about 20 years ago, you know, the National Institutes of Mental Health, you know, really took a hard look at its own data and said, oh, my gosh, all this work on mental health, you know, intervention and treatment that our black and brown, you know, friends, colleagues, individuals really haven't been well represented in these numbers. So we really need to do the hard, authentic work to earn that trust and to embed into that work, taking a critical self-reflection on how we as a system may be, you know, are part of the problem. What are the embedded structures of racism that are still present? And, you know, what we're finding, for instance, you know, with our, you know, our behavioral supports work for children, which, you know, we do that in with child care centers, is, you know, we can come in and we can do the support to, you know, help reduce referral to mental health services because, you know, people are understanding and seeing children through a different lens and responding to children's behaviors differently. And part of that work that is we're doing deliberately now is to have conversations around cultural humility and how to embed that into this practice and continue bringing that piece into place. And that's an example of how, you know, we can continue to do these preventative services, but in a way that really expands scope and addresses these issues that Sean and Jackie and you are talking about.
No, this hour has flown by. And
I know it. I just wanted to say one last thing. Involve practitioners of color.
Yeah.
I'll just end it there.
Succinct and powerful. Jackie, the director of the Rock Future Alliance, always good to have you, Jackie Campbell. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being, for asking.
You got it. Sean Nelms from East. Thank you, Sean.
Hey, thank you. That experience.
And Anne Marie White, Elizabeth Devaney from the Children's Institute. Thank you very much.
We're so grateful. Thank you.
For Rob, Megan, I'm Evan. Have a nice afternoon.